You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You have my sword.
And you have my bow.
And my trowel.
Hello, you're listening to episode 44 of And My Trowel, where we look at the fantastic side of archaeology and the archaeological side of fantasy. I am Tilly.
And I'm Ash.
And we're here with Ronja Lau, preparing to become the Norns of Norse mythology. Just until they're back from holiday, anyway.
Maybe we should do a little recap of exactly what we were talking about.
Right. Yes. Good idea.
Okay. So we've been tasked with covering the Norns, the weavers of fate, life and destiny, while they're away on a much needed break. However, we don't really have a clue about weaving. So we invited Ronja Lau, a prehistoric archaeologist and textile specialist, to join our coven to make this duo into a trio so she can help us figure out just how one goes about weaving fate. Oh, and the Norns left us a little bit of their weaving ends as a clue.
Yeah, so the question remains, yes, they've left us this warp end. Speaking as someone who has nothing to do with textile archaeology, how does that help us? So, Ronja, you are a textile archaeologist. How can we go about analyzing these sort of ends that they've left us? What kind of analysis can you do as a textiles archaeologist?
Ah, that's a great question. I love that. That's basically all I do. All of the textile analysis. If we have textiles, and I said also earlier that this is not always the case in archaeology because we have organic materials and they decay quite fast. But if we have textile remains, we can extract a lot of information from these textiles, actually. We start basically by looking at the textiles under the microscope and ask questions, of course, about their characteristics. For example, of which material were the textiles made? And from prehistory, we have more or less wool, like sheep wool, and also plant fibers, like linen or hemp, for example. And if we have a good textile fragment, we can also ask questions about the quality of the textile and analyze the quality. And we measure, for example, the thread diameter of one thread each. We can also say how dense is the fabric, how densely woven it is. So we count how many threads are in the fabric by centimeter, and the higher the number, the more finer and also more delicately woven it is. And then we can also ask questions about the dye stuff. If we have good samples where we can also see the dye stuff and the different colors of the textiles, we can make gas chromatography analysis on which chemical residues there are and which plants or other, for example, insect dyes have been used to dye this textile. So you see, from archaeological or textile research to also natural sciences, we do a lot of different analysis on those textiles.
I was expecting just we could maybe see like what material they were using, and then you're like, oh, we can see, we can tell what the weaver had for breakfast, and we can
and I'm assuming that opens up, like, especially with insect stuff and the dyes, it could open up trade potentially. Tell you a little bit about that.
Yeah, definitely. For example, for my textiles, we have evidence for camas dye, which is an insect dye from the Mediterranean. And these insects live in trees in warmer areas, and they have been traded to Central Europe as a dye stuff. And they dye this kind of pinkish red. I always say it's like the Telekom magenta color.
More or less magenta red, Telekom magenta.
Don't quote me, but
yeah. I love that.
Recategorizing textile archaeology on this one.
And it's very unique. You can hardly imitate this color by with local plant, for example. So that this is an insect dye. And we have this insect dye also in our salt mine, and can see how far the trade also has gone with the salt and also with other materials, but also textiles and the resources for textile productions are also traded and are not only locally produced. So that's always very interesting.
Oh, that's so cool. And you mentioned you can see like the quality. To me, that seems like quite a subjective thing, or is there specific parameters you look at?
Yeah, sure. When textile archaeology started to evolve as a special research topic in archaeology, you have to make some so yeah, some basic research and to set some scales and how to categorize anything. So there has been a lot of research done on how we can categorize the different qualities of prehistoric textiles, because it is not the same as modern textiles, of course, because all of these are handmade with different resources and materials. But for example, if we take a thread and we measure the diameter of the thread, they tend to start by 0.1 millimeters and they can go to 1 millimeter. And of course, a 1 millimeter thread is quite thick. So you can, yeah, it's a, maybe it will be a cozy, fluffy and thick, I don't know, coat, for example. But if you have a thread that's 0.1 millimeter, that is extremely fine. And we see these extremely fine textiles and threads also in prehistory, and they are handmade with hand spindles and distaffs, and they have been woven on warp-weighted looms. So the skill and the technology the people had back then is not worse or not comparable with modern technology, because we are using machines, of course, today. But I think we had now quite the good, yeah, terminology, so that we can say, okay, these are fine textiles, middle fine, more coarse, or even, yeah, the coarsest ones. But of course, we need more textiles to just to see if this is like everywhere the case, not only in prehistoric Austria, because we have a salt mine here, but also in other areas. Yeah.
Oh, no. Does that mean you have to keep working and keep being employed as a textile archaeologist? Oh, what a shame.
Yes. Oh, no. Wow. If anybody is willing to give me a lot of money to work on.
There's essential work taking place here. We need
money. That's fantastic. So I'm wondering, especially with the salt mines, is there a type of pattern, like a twill or something, that is like predominant, or are they making lots of different stuff?
Oh, that's a very good question, because like these patterns and colors and how they designed their textiles is also a very personal question. We cannot ask the people why they did that, but we can compare, for example, now the textiles already from Dürnberg to Hallstatt, because they're more or less parallel in some years. The salt mines have been in use, I think, 200 years parallel. But of course, Hallstatt is a bit older and Dürnberg is a bit younger. You can also see a change of design and patterns and use of colors and also use of patterns. So in Dürnberg, it is very common, or quite common, if you use pattern textiles, to use stripes. So stripes are very common, and also like thin ones, like not these block stripes, but very delicate, very fine ones, always in high contrast, like for example, dark blue with light threads in the pattern, or reddish colors or greenish colors. And so they really like to do that. And they also love their monochrome textiles in really dark blue. I always call this Dürnberg blue, because it's very specialized that we have
more
a
terminology is coming out here. Add that to the telecom agenda.
It's even better, because it's quite interesting that we have such a high amount of dark blue textiles. And in contrast to Hallstatt, where there is a lot of Czech patterns actually, and more block stripes and more broader or coarser patterns, you can really see a change, maybe also in identity and culture. So we don't know for sure why they did that, but that's the point of research at the moment. And they like twill a lot. Twill and tabby are the two most used weave types. There are, of course, different weave types in time and period, but they are also not as much used in Dürnberg. They set with the twill and the tabby, and then they used color and pattern to identify themselves, maybe even more.
Ken, speaking as a non-weaver, what is twill and tabby?
Yeah, that's a good question.
Sorry, I know you guys know what you're talking about, but I have no clue. I was in the background going like, yes, twill.
Right, this one. So if you're using a loom, and it doesn't matter if it's a warp-weighted loom or horizontal loom or whatever loom, you always have different possibilities on how to weave a textile. So the threads who are attached to the warp, to the loom are the warp threads, because they are set there. And then we have the weft. The weft is shoot or shut through from left to right to create the
that binding thing that you like push back and forth.
Yes. And you have the opportunity to either let the weft go up and down each of the warp threads. So alternating, one up, one down, one up, one down. So this is the tabby one. This is the very simplest, very easy form of weaving a textile. And then you have the opportunity to also go up and down every two warp threads. And for example, this twill pattern, which is also very much used in prehistory, we also use it today. So if you're wearing a blue jeans at the moment, I don't know if you are, but blue jeans are always in twill. So if you don't know how a twill looks like, go to your blue jeans
and look at the jeans.
It has these, what is it called in English? Pellicular,
they go from one corner to the other. Yeah.
So this look is very dim.
Those are like dots within the lines because they've gone up and down and up and down and up and down and up and down.
Yeah. And tartan tends to be a twill.
Yeah, also. Yeah.
I could have my tartan blanket here as well. Look at there that. There you go. All these examples.
How I remember warp and weft, because I always used to get them mixed up, as warp is, it sounds longer. So that's your long threads. And weft is left, right, weft. And it's short. So it's the short bits.
That makes sense.
Great.
It did help me. I was like, I don't know what a warp is. Oh, no, I do.
Also,
okay.
If you say warp, your mouth goes in more of a long, like up and down. Whereas if you say weft, it goes weft. Like your cheeks go out and it's like long, like wide.
Left, weft. Yeah. Yeah.
See, we're helping.
Yeah, we listen, we don't judge, you know. So,
is fine. Whatever helps, whatever helps. As well, though, I wanted to ask you, Ronja, what do you have, like, a favorite piece of fabric that you've analyzed from all of your work?
Yeah, I actually do. It's a great question because I got really attached to the textiles I'm working with because I have looked at so many textiles and I can look at them and say, okay, these one are from Dürrenberg, these one are from Hallstatt. But there's one type of textile which is very special, only found at Dürrenberg. And this is actually a fake purple textile. And we have, or I have now, multiple pieces of evidence for these fake purple textiles. So you have to imagine that the color range is not as wide in the prehistory as we have it now. So you have the plants and you can play around with the recipes, of course, to have different shades of colors. But for example, colors like purple are really rare because the Mediterranean, the archaeologists from the Mediterranean, they know about the real shellfish purple, of course, since the Bronze Age, or even there are even older sources for that. And in the Roman period, purple was quite commonly used also for the emperors and for the aristocracy, and a very expensive dye because it was so hard to get from these shellfish. They were collected from the sea and the recipes are very difficult. And so the color itself had an impact on your identity and who you are, and could communicate a lot without saying anything just by wearing the color. And of course, like here in my textiles, we have the Celts who are in contact with the Mediterranean area and they knew what the people were wearing. And we have the Etruscan, like the pre-Roman people in Italy, and they were already using the purple dye for their textiles. And so the Celts knew about this color, and as we are very human, we always want to have what the others have. Just imagine, I once saw this, I don't know, whatever tunic with this interesting color. I have never seen this before. I want that too. But it is very expensive. The trade is not really working because it is not possible to trade the raw material of the dye the huge distances to Austria. So they had to come up with a different technique to get this purple. And they start faking it, actually. And they start faking it by mixing blue and red fibers. So the fibers of the sheep wool were dyed first. One batch in blue and one batch in red. And then they mix the fibers by, for example, combing them together. And then where they were spinning the fibers like usual, and then they were weaving the textile as usual. And then you really, from afar, you can really see the purple tint it gets, because if the sun is hitting the textile and you're moving and you really get the purple shades and shine on the textiles, even if you're not using real purple. And that is actually the first evidence of imitation purple, I call it fake purple, in Central Europe, out of the Mediterranean, and as early as the Celts, and not from Roman sources. So
that's
so cool.
I can just imagine a Celt standing on a hobby like, don't come closer. No, I
don't
swear.
Arms length. But imagine, like, you were the person that came up with that, and your loom shop the next day must have been like,
just quietly rack up the prices.
Yeah, that's going to be a lot. Thank you.
Yeah.
I've just realized, by the way, all that talk about warping and wefting before, are we going to have to warp this loom? Because it doesn't have any kind of strings on it or anything at the moment.
Oh, God. I don't know how to do that. I think it could take days.
Okay, then we better get cracking.
Okay, guys, we'll be right back. Okay, so that's going to take much longer than I expected.
Yeah, it's a good thing that we have Ronja on hand to give us some help and guidance. Thank you, Ronja. That was very useful. Actually, I think this might also be a good time. It's been so interesting learning about textile archaeology, but the whole point we have Ronja here is to help us, like, analyze these fragments from the Norns to try and work out how we can replicate the weave and then get an idea of how we can actually weave fate in their place, because it sounds like quite an important job. So you mentioned before that as well as analyzing textiles and doing textile archaeology, you've also been involved for a long time in reenactment. Does that mean that you also create your own clothing and outfits based on kind of past fashions?
Oh yeah, I do. I have different time periods and outfits from mostly the Bronze Age to the Middle Ages, and I recreated quite a lot by myself, but also with the help of other very experienced craftspeople.
Ah, nice. And what kinds of things do you then, if you're creating an outfit, what sort of stuff? I know this is way down the line. We don't need to necessarily think of this when we're doing the Norn stuff, but I'm just curious again. So we're going down another rabbit hole. So what kind of stuff do we have to, like, take into account if you want to create an outfit or a textile or anything for reenactment purposes?
Directly accurate.
Yeah, of course, there are different aspects on how accurate you want to be, on how, of course, how much money you want to spend on your outfit. None of it is very cheap, unfortunately.
I can imagine.
But if you want to have, like, a good base and where you can also evolve a bit more and you start with good textiles, of course, don't choose anything too modern. So if you are thinking about choosing a textile and starting with a material, I would recommend always using wool, like real sheep wool, because other fibers like cotton or, yeah, even, I don't know, some artificial other fibers are not looking the same as sheep wool. You don't have to choose real plant dyes, because I think there are a lot of shops at the moment who also replicate plant dyes by using chemical dyes, and they're a lot cheaper. Depending on how much money you have, you can either decide, okay, someone is dyeing a plant dye textile for me, or even if you want to try it yourself, go for it. But if you want to make a compromise, you can also use that. But the colors, they really look different than we are used now. So they are not as bright, they are not as shiny. So they are more, yeah, of like tones, or more darker sometimes. But yeah, you can choose whatever you fancy, of course. And then you have to choose, of course, the right, what can I say, how to tailor your clothes for different time periods. There are different styles and outfits and, yeah, possibilities on how to sew a textile and get into sewing. Try to practice a bit your hand-sew game, because you're not using a machine. Yeah, unfortunately. But that's basically it. And of course, there's a learning curve. And I also started with not well-looking textile. But that's a great opportunity to learn something new, to learn a craft, because we're not used to make our own textiles anymore and our own clothes. Mm. So we go to a shop and buy a t-shirt or pants, and we don't know how it was made, where it was made, and how long it took also to make it.
Yeah, that's true, actually. And sometimes recently there's been a lot of controversy with, like, plastic being in, like, too much plastic being in clothing and stuff like that too. You did mention tailoring, but I do wonder how much do the different weaving techniques affect the final piece? So you said tailoring's so important, but does the weaving also come into that too?
Oh, yeah, definitely, of course. It's mainly the quality of the textile which will have an impact on how your dress or your tunic or whatever will look like. So if you're choosing, for example, a very fine thread and also weaving a very fine textile, it will fall differently on your own body. You can see this actually quite well on, for example, also on Greek or Roman statues, because when they are dressed, and also the gods, for example, they always have like really flowy and very thin and airy looking dresses and clothing on. And this is only created by using really thin and high quality textiles. And if you're using a more coarser or more thicker threads, you won't have this flowy fall. It will look a bit more stiff maybe, and it will not soothe that well maybe, or it will have an impact on how you look like actually. And you will see from afar if this person is dressed in high quality clothing or not.
Which I guess you could say is the same in modern fashions too, right? Mm-hmm. If you have fake... what's it called? I don't know, a lower quality material or something, and you try to like recreate like a dress. Yeah, a knockoff, that's the word. Thank you. I was like, what's the word? Like a knockoff version of something, even if it would be on the floor, like looking exactly the same. As soon as you wear it, people are going to be like, wow, that's not the thing. Which, yeah, no, but that's really interesting. There's so many different things you have to take into account if you want to be like, depending on what you're reenacting as well, I guess, in terms of that side of things. What's, out of curiosity, what's your favorite like reenactment outfit that you've made? You've mentioned that you do a couple of different time periods.
Mm-hmm. My favorite one at the moment would be my early Iron Age period dress, because I really like the simplicity of it. It's like a peblos dress, so it's a tube-like textile. It's not tailored actually, but it's very common for the early Iron Age to dress in peblos dresses. And it's fastened with fibulas on each shoulder, so left and right.
Oh, nice.
And it really has a big, shiny belt plate. You can really polish it, and it looks like a mirror which you're wearing on your hips.
Yes,
and
right.
It has like, yeah, it's simple, but just so great. And the textile itself is wool. It's red-orange madder dye, and it's a Czech pattern, so it's also very hushed. And it accomplished, the outfit is, there's also a light blue veil to it. And the color contrast and the metal objects, the jewelry, like really big glass bead necklaces, and everything belongs together. It's not only the textile or the dress, but also the jewelry and the outfit and how you style it. And then it becomes a real outfit, and you can really imagine on, wow, okay, this is what people could have looked like in the past. And you dress like that, and I always feel like I'm making a small time travel, and I really enjoy that.
I really liked the fashion show that you guys did.
Yeah.
It's so cool to see, like you say, all these different real outfits from different places and different periods and stuff. It was really interesting to see that. Which were the people all involved also all textile archaeologists, or was that sort of a...
No. When we do these fashion shows, which we have done quite often now in the past, we need so many people for the different outfits that we usually collect volunteers, actually, like from the universities, from the students, from, I don't know, friends and families, wherever we go. So these are, none of those were even archaeologists or has something to do with archaeology. Even I think I was the only one, and with my colleague Katie, we were the only one attending at the fashion show, which were actually textile archaeologists. So 2 out of 30, I don't know. But they all did a very good job at getting dressed by us, and we told them, okay, how they should move also, because sometimes the dresses need to be moved in a special way, or if they have jingly jewelry, like say, okay, now do your Shakira moves because we want to hear those jingles and get your 2 seconds moment on the stage.
Like a diamond.
And use the opportunity to, to be Bronze Age, Stone Age, Iron Age, or Roman, or whatever person of the time. And they really did a good job. Yeah.
I think I would pick Iron Age. I think I would. Yeah. Okay, but are you ever tempted to make the imitation purple?
Not yet. Not yet. No. But I sure will do that. Yeah.
Well, I'm thinking we don't necessarily need to make a whole outfit or anything since we're weaving fate, but we just need to work out now what the Nones did. So shall we think about the analysis?
Right, yes. Sorry, it's just all so interesting. I like learning all of these different things. Yeah, so earlier, Ronja, you mentioned different analysis methods that can be used. We talked about that last episode as well. But based on what we know of the Norns and the weaving of fate, just from an initial look, or if we even just think about what could have been used, could we make some initial hypotheses? For example, material. Like, what material would we want to use if we're weaving fate, based on your experience of different materials? What would you recommend?
If we're speaking about Norse mythology and we set the time maybe into early Middle Ages and Viking period stuff, the most important or, I don't know, fateful fabric or textile or material probably would have been silk. Because we have quite some silk samples and sources from Viking Age burials, also from Birka and other places, which was used as, of course, trade, but also to show your high rank and your status, and in combination with maybe also metal threads, for example, gold or silver metal threads in combination with the silk. This is, wow, top of the notch. Yeah, if you want to say something important, use that.
So that's a really good question, because then we could basically base the fate. If they're a good person, maybe we could give them that. If they're a bad person,
the power.
Like, do you know what I mean? Like, that's the thing. How do we judge it morally?
You get this whole bit of sack that I used. You get the fine gold silk thread.
The other one, the itchy and coarse wool from, I don't know.
Makes your hands swell up.
Yeah. Maybe.
That would be cool. And so I guess thickness, probably, if we're going with the with silk thing, it would probably be fine.
Very fine, extremely very fine, of course, yeah.
Okay, yeah.
Definitely.
It would take a while to weave it.
Speaking of weave, as a professional weaver now, I know that there's twill and tabby. There's probably others as well, but those are the only two I know.
There's many. Okay.
So what kind of warp or weft, I don't know what the wording is, would you use? What would you do? Twill tab?
Depending on what the textile should be used as, maybe also, because you have to make up your mind on which weave type I choose for what purpose of the textile should have later. So for example, if you just want to weave a coarse cloak because someone was really naughty and, you know, they're not getting anything better, you can use a twill because it will be faster. You don't have to make up your mind before that. Yeah, nothing special will be done with the textile afterwards. But if you have a real purpose for the textile, and it may have been, for example, if you use a twill textile, you also have the possibility to make it a bit more stretchy, even if it's wool or silk or something, some material which is not stretchy at all, because this is a very modern thing to have stretchy textiles. But on how the twill is made, it will have some, so it will give you more movement. It will be closer to your body, but will not keep you from your movements or horse riding or working or whatever you want to do. This will give you more opportunity, actually. So I think twill will be the better option if you want to do something fancy.
Okay, that sounds good. And I was tempted to suggest telecom magenta, but I think that maybe the fake purple sounds like a cool color. Mm-hmm. Or I don't know, would there be other colors if we're thinking specifically of Norse mythology that would have been...
Yeah, I think they also had a really good trade connections to different areas and also used different dye stuffs, but also the use of local dye stuffs, but in a different recipe. For example, a very high amount of madder or a very high amount of woad, so you get really high contrast and intense colors, is as rich and luxurious as a traded magenta color. It's always about, on how much resources you can spend on your textiles. And if you want to make a really bright red or really dark blue textile, that's also really well.
We're going to have a very smelly loom shop.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, okay, I think that sounds like a good start. We know that we're going to basically do silk, probably really high contrast colours, mm-hmm. and in a twill. No. But I don't think we've decided what we're weaving.
We'll get to that when we. I think it's going to take us long enough to set up the loom.
Yeah. So I think let's go and set up the equipment first, and then we can see if we're correct, if the Norns hate us or not when they get back.
That's the end of this episode of Am My Trowel. Thank you so much, Ronja, for joining us. We learned so much. I wasn't expecting to learn quite this much, but we have learned so much. Before we go, do you have any kind of exciting projects coming up soon or anything else that you'd like to share with our listeners?
You can always have a look on what I'm doing in my research. You can follow me on Instagram, and I will show a lot of insights on what textile archaeology actually looks like. And I also always do some presentations and sometimes occur on fashion shows in all of Europe. So if you want to attend something like that, you can follow me, and then, you are informed about everything I do in the future.
Perfect. Thank you. And we'll be sharing, as always, all of the information in the show notes. So do check it out there. We hope that you all enjoyed our quest today. If you did, as always, please leave us a review wherever you listen to us. It really helps to support us and the rest of the APN. If you have any ideas for future episodes, or maybe you just wanted to discuss a past episode more, get in contact through social media, or you can also join the free APN Discord server, where we are also hosting live monthly recordings from all of our different shows. So definitely go and check that out. We'd love to hear your feedback as well. So any interaction is great. As I said, all contact information for both us and Ronja, as well as further reading and links to the points discussed today, can be found in the show notes.
Wait, listen. Tilly, can you hear something? Someone singing.
It sounds more, I don't know, chanting?
Well, I think I can make it out. Lord of Moria, speak friend and enter?
Speak friend? I have no idea what they're going... Oh, hang on. Oh, God. I've completely... You know what? I've just seen the fruit bowl over there. I have been dying for a melon all day. Uh-oh.
The Archaeology Podcast Network is 10 years old this year. Our executive producer is Ashley Airy. Our social media coordinator is Matilda Siebrecht. And our chief editor is Rachel Roden. The Archaeology Podcast Network was co-founded by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle in 2014 and is part of Cultural Media and DigTech LLC.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.